A slanting shaft of brightness marked the entrance to one of the levels of the arena, and now, as we passed it, the crowd let out a roar. Then swiftly we were in the dark again, and climbing, the roar seeming to sink below us, and we were moved into a bright blue light, and down a ramp, to each side of which, stretching away in a curve, I could see rows of blurred faces. Then suddenly I was blinded, and felt myself crash into the man ahead of me. "It always happens the first time," he shouted, stopping to let me get my balance, his voice small in the roar. "It's the spotlight!" It had picked us up now, and beaming just ahead, led us into the arena and encircled us full in its beam, the crowd thundering. The song burst forth like a rocket to the marching tempo of clapping hands. "John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. His soul is marching on." Imagine that, I thought. They make the old song sound new. At first I was as remote as though I stood in the highest balcony looking on. Then I walked flush into the vibrations of the voices and felt an electric tingling along my spine. We marched toward a flag-draped platform set near the front of the arena, moving through an aisle left between rows of people in folding chairs, then on to the platform, past a number of women who stood when we came on. With a nod, Brother Jack indicated our chairs and we faced the applause, standing. Below and above us was the audience, row after row of faces, the arena a bowl-shaped aggregation of humanity. Then I saw the policemen and was disturbed. What if they recognized me? They were all along the wall. I touched the arm of the man ahead, seeing him turn, his mouth halting in a verse of the song. "Why all the police?" I said, leaning forward on the back of his chair. "Cops, don't worry. Tonight they're ordered to protect us. The meeting is of great political consequences," he said, turning away. Who ordered them to protect us, I thought. But now, the song was ending, and the building rang with applause, yells until the chant burst from the rear and spread. "No more dispossessing of the dispossessed! No more dispossessing of the dispossessed!" The audience seemed to have become one, its breathing and articulation synchronized. I looked at Brother Jack. He stood up front beside a microphone, his feet planted solidly on the dirty canvas-covered platform, looking from side to side, his posture dignified and benign, like a bemused father listening to the performance of his adoring children. I saw his hand go up in a salute, and the audience thundered. And I seemed to move in close, like the lens of a camera, focusing into the scene and feeling the heat and excitement and the pounding of voice and applause against my diaphragm, my eyes flying from face to face, swiftly, fleetingly, searching for someone I could recognize, for someone from the old life, and seeing the faces become vaguer and vaguer the farther they receded from the platform. The speeches began. First, an invocation by a Negro preacher. Then a woman spoke of what was happening to the children. Then came speeches on various aspects of the economic and political situation. I listened carefully, trying to snatch a phrase here, a word there, from the arsenal of hard, precise terms. It was becoming a high-keyed evening. Songs flared between speeches. Chants exploded as spontaneously as shouts at a southern revival. And I was somehow attuned to it all. Could feel it, physically. Sitting with my feet on the soiled canvas, I felt as though I had wandered into the percussion section of a symphony orchestra. It worked on me so thoroughly that I soon gave up trying to memorize phrases and simply allowed the excitement to carry me along. Someone pulled on my coat sleeve. My turn had come. I went toward the microphone where Brother Jack himself waited, entering the spot of light that surrounded me like a seamless cage of stainless steel. I halted. The light was so strong that I could no longer see the audience, the bowl of human faces. It was as though a semi-transparent curtain had dropped between us, but through which they could see me, for they were applauding, without themselves being seen. I felt the hard, mechanical isolation of the hospital machine, and I didn't like it. I stood, barely hearing Brother Jack's introduction. Then he was through, and there was an encouraging burst of applause, and I thought, they remember. Some of them were there. The microphone was strange and unnerving. I approached it incorrectly, my voice sounding raspy and full of air, and after a few words I halted, embarrassed. I was getting off to a bad start. Something had to be done. I leaned toward the vague audience closest to the platform and said, "Sorry, folks. Up to now they've kept me so far away from these shiny electric gadgets I haven't learned the technique. And to tell you the truth, it looks to me like it might bite. Just look at it. It looks like the steel skull of man. Do you think he died of dispossession?" It worked, and while they laughed, someone came and made an adjustment. "Don't stand too close," he advised. "How's that?" I said, hearing my voice boom deep and vibrant over the arena. "Is that better?" There was a ripple of applause. "You see, all I needed was a chance. You've granted it. Now it's up to me." The applause grew stronger, and from down front, a man's far-crying voice called out, "We with you, brother. You pitch him, we catch him." That was all I needed. I'd made a contact, and it was as though his voice was that of them all. I was wound up, nervous. I might have been anyone, might have been trying to speak in a foreign language, for I couldn't remember the correct words and phrases from the pamphlets. I had to fall back upon tradition, and since it was a political meeting, I selected one of the political techniques that I'd heard so often at home. The old, down-to-earth, I'm sick and tired of the way they've been treating us approach. I couldn't see them, so I addressed the microphone and the cooperative voice before me. "You know, there are those who think we who are gathered here are dumb," I shouted. "Tell me if I'm right."
"That's a strike, brother," the voice called. "You pitched a strike."
"Yes, they think we're dumb. They call us the common people. But I've been sitting here listening and looking and trying to understand what's so common about us. I think they're guilty of a gross misstatement of fact. We are the uncommon people."
"Another strike,"
the voice called in the thunder, and I paused, holding up my hand to halt the noise. "Yes, we're the uncommon people, and I'll tell you why. They call us dumb, and they treat us dumb. And what do they do with dumb ones? Think about it. Look around. They've got a slogan and a policy. They've got what Brother Jack would call a theory and a practice. It's never give a sucker an even break. It's dispossess him, evict him, use his empty head for a spittoon and his back for a doormat. It's break him, deprive him of his wages. It's use his protest as a sounding brass to frighten him into silence. It's beat his ideas and his hopes and homely aspirations into a tinkling symbol. A small, cracked symbol to tinkle on the 4th of July. Only muffle it. Don't let it sound too loud. Beat it in stop time. Give the dumb bunnies the soft shoe dance, the big wormy apple, the Chicago getaway, the shoe fly, don't bother me. And do you know what makes us so uncommon?" I whispered hoarsely.
"We let them do it."
The silence was profound. The smoke boiled in the spotlight.
"Another strike,"
I heard the voice call sadly.
"Ain't no use to protest the decision."
And I thought, is he with me or against me? Dispossession. Dispossession is the word, I went on. "They've tried to dispossess us of our manhood and womanhood, of our childhood and adolescence. You heard the sister's statistics on our infant mortality rate. Don't you know you're lucky to be uncommonly born? Why, they even tried to dispossess us of our dislike of being dispossessed. And I'll tell you something else. If we don't resist, pretty soon they'll succeed. These are the days of dispossession, the season of homelessness, the time of evictions. We'll be dispossessed of the very brains in our heads, and we're so uncommon that we can't even see it. Perhaps we're too polite. Perhaps we don't care to look at unpleasantness. They think we're blind, uncommonly blind, and I don't wonder. Think about it. They've dispossessed us each of one eye from the day we're born. So now we can only see in straight, white lines. We're a nation of one-eyed mice. Did you ever see such a sight in your life? Such an uncommon sight.
And ain't a farmer's wife in the house, the voice called through the titters of bitter laughter. It's another strike.
I leaned forward. You know, if we aren't careful, they'll slip up on our blind sides and plop, out goes our last good eye and we're blind as bats. Someone's afraid we'll see something. Maybe that's why so many of our fine friends are present tonight. Blue steel pistols and blue serge suits and all. But I believe one eye is enough to lose without resistance, and I think that's your belief. So let's get together. Did you ever notice, my dumb one-eyed brothers, how two totally blind men can get together and help one another along? They stumble, they bump into things, but they avoid dangers, too. They get along. Let's get together, uncommon people. With both our eyes, we may see what makes us so uncommon. We'll see who makes us so uncommon. Up to now, we've been like a couple of one-eyed men walking down opposite sides of the street. Someone starts throwing bricks, and we start blaming each other and fighting among ourselves. But we're mistaken, because there's a third party present. There's a smooth, oily scoundrel running down the middle of the wide gray street throwing stones. He's the one. He's doing the damage. He claims he needs the space. He calls it his freedom. And he knows he's got us on our blind side, and he's been popping away till he's got us silly, uncommonly silly. In fact, his freedom has got us damn nigh blind. Hush now. Don't call no names, I called, holding up my palm. I say to hell with this guy. I say, come on, cross over. Let's make an alliance. I look out for you, and you look out for me. I'm good at catching, and I've got a damn good pitching arm.
You don't pitch no balls, brother. Not a single one.
Let's make a miracle, I shouted. Let's take back our pillaged eyes. Let's reclaim our sight. Let's combine and spread our vision. Peep around the corner. There's a storm coming. Look down the avenue. There's only one enemy. Can't you see his face? It was a natural pause. There was applause, but as it burst, I realized that the flow of words had stopped. What would I do when they started to listen again? I leaned forward, straining to see through the barrier of light. They were mine out there, and I couldn't afford to lose them. Yet I suddenly felt naked, sensing that the words were returning and that something was about to be said that I shouldn't reveal. "Look at me," the words ripped from my solar plexus. "I haven't lived here long. Times are hard. I've known despair. I'm from the South. And since coming here, I've known eviction. I'd come to distrust the world. But look at me now. Something strange is happening. I'm here before you. I must confess." And suddenly, Brother Jack was beside me, pretending to adjust the microphone. "Careful now," he whispered. "Don't end your usefulness before you've begun." "I'm all right," I said, leaning toward the mic.
"May I confess?" I shouted. "You are my friends. We share a common disinheritance. And it's said that confession is good for the soul. Have I your permission?" "You batting 500, brother," the voice called.
There was a stir behind me. I waited until it was quiet and hurried on.
"Silence is consent," I said. "So I'll have it out. I'll confess it."
My shoulders were squared, my chin thrust forward, and my eyes focused straight into the light.
"Something strange and miraculous and transforming is taking place in me right now, as I stand here before you."
I could feel the words forming themselves, slowly falling into place. The light seemed to boil, opalescently, like liquid soap shaken gently in a bottle. Let me describe it. It is something odd. It is something that I'm sure I'd never experience anywhere else in the world. I feel your eyes upon me. I hear the pulse of your breathing. And now, at this moment, with your black and white eyes upon me, I feel... I stumbled in a stillness so complete that I could hear the gears of the huge clock mounted somewhere on the balcony, gnawing upon time.
"What is it, sir? What do you feel?"
a shrill voice cried. My voice fell to a husky whisper. I feel, suddenly, that I have become more human. Do you understand? More human. Not that I have become a man, for I was born a man, but that I am more human. I feel strong. I feel able to get things done. I feel that I can see sharp and clear and far down the dim corridor of history, and in it I can hear the footsteps of militant fraternity. No. Wait. Let me confess. I feel the urge to affirm my feelings. I feel that here, after a long and desperate and uncommonly blind journey, I have come home. Home. With your eyes upon me, I feel that I have found my true family, my true people, my true country. I am a new citizen of the country of your vision, a native of your fraternal land. I feel that here, tonight, in this old arena, the new is being born and the vital old revived. In each of you, in me, in us all, sisters, brothers, we are the true patriots, the citizens of tomorrow's world will be dispossessed no more. The applause struck like a clap of thunder. I stood transfixed, unable to see my body, quivering with the roar. I made an indefinite movement. What should I do? Wave to them? I faced the shouts, cheers, shrill whistling, my eyes burning from the light. I felt a large tear roll down my face, and I wiped it away with embarrassment. Others were starting down. Why didn't someone help me to get out of the spot before I spoiled everything? But with the tears came an increase of applause, and I lifted my head, surprised, my eyes streaming. The sound seemed to roar up in waves. They had begun to stomp the floor, and I was laughing and bowing my head, now unashamed. It grew in volume. The sound of splitting wood came from the rear. I grew tired, but still they cheered until finally I gave up and started back toward the chairs. Red spots danced before my eyes. Someone took my hand and leaned toward my ear.
"You did it, goddammit! You did it!"
And I was puzzled by the hot mixture of hate and admiration bursting through his words as I thanked him and removed my hand from his crushing grasp.
"Thanks,"
I said, but the others had raised them to the right pitch. I shuddered. He sounded as though he would like to throttle me. I couldn't see, and there was much confusion, and suddenly someone spun me around, pulling me off balance, and I felt myself pressed against warm feminine softness, holding on.
"Oh, brother, brother," a woman's voice cried into my ear. "Little brother."
And I felt the hot, moist pressure of her lips upon my cheek. Blurred figures bumped about me. I stumbled as in a game of blind man's bluff. My hands were shaken, my back pounded, my face was sprayed with the saliva of enthusiasm, and I decided that the next time I stood in the spotlight, it would be wise to wear dark glasses. It was a deafening demonstration. We left them cheering, knocking over chairs, stomping the floor. Brother Jack guided me off the platform. "It's time we left," he shouted. "Things have truly begun to move. All that energy must be organized." He guided me through the shouting crowd, hands continuing to touch me as I stumbled along. Then we entered the dark passage, and when we reached the end, the spots faded from my eyes and I began to see again. Brother Jack paused at the door. "Listen to them," he said, "just waiting to be told what to do." And I could still hear the applause booming behind us. Then several of the others broke off their conversation and faced us, the applause muffled down behind the closing door.
"Well, what do you think?" Brother Jack said enthusiastically. "How's that for a starter?"
There was a tense silence. I looked from face to face, black and white, feeling swift panic. They were grim.
"Well?"
Brother Jack said, his voice suddenly hard. I could hear the creaking of someone's shoes.
"Well?"
he repeated. Then the man with the pipe spoke up, a swift charge of tension building with his words.
"It was a most unsatisfactory beginning," he said quietly, punctuating the unsatisfactory with a stab of his pipe. He was looking straight at me, and I was puzzled. I looked at the others. Their faces were noncommittal, stolid.
"Unsatisfactory," Brother Jack exploded. "And what alleged process of thought led to that brilliant pronouncement?"
"This is no time for cheap sarcasm, brother," the brother with the pipe said.
"Sarcasm?
You made the sarcasm. No, it isn't a time for sarcasm, nor for imbecilities, nor for plain damn fooleries. This is a key moment in the struggle. Things have just begun to move, and suddenly you are unhappy. You are afraid of success? What's wrong? Isn't this just what we've been working for? Again, ask yourself. You are the great leader. Look into your crystal ball."
Brother Jack swore.
"Brothers,"
someone said. Brother Jack swore and swung to another brother.
"You," he said to the husky man, "have you the courage to tell me what's going on here? Have we become a street corner gang?"
Silence. Someone shuffled his feet. The man with the pipe was looking now at me.
Did I do something wrong?" I said.
"The worst you could have done," he said coldly.
Stunned, I looked at him wordlessly.
"Never mind," Brother Jack said, suddenly calm. "Just what is the problem, brother? Let's have it out right here. Just what is your complaint?"
"Not a complaint, an opinion. If we are still allowed to express our opinions," the brother with the pipe said.
"Your opinion, then," Brother Jack said.
"In my opinion, the speech was wild, hysterical, politically irresponsible, and dangerous," he snapped. "And worse than that, it was incorrect."
He pronounced incorrect as though the term described the most heinous crime imaginable, and I stared at him open-mouthed, feeling a vague guilt.
"So," Brother Jack said, looking from face to face, "there's been a caucus, and decisions have been made. Did you take minutes, Brother Chairman? Have you recorded your wise disputations?"
"There was no caucus, and the opinion still holds," the brother with the pipe said.
"No meeting, but just the same, there has been a caucus, and decisions have been reached even before the event is finished."
"But, brother," someone tried to intervene. "A most brilliant operation," Brother Jack went on, smiling now.
"A consummate example of skilled theoretical Nijinsky's leaping ahead of history. But come down, brothers, come down, or you'll land on your dialectics. The stage of history hasn't built that far. The month after next, perhaps, but not yet. And what do you think, Brother Restrum?" he asked, pointing to a big fellow of the shape and size of supercargo.
"I think the brother's speech was backward and reactionary," he said.
I wanted to answer, but could not. No wonder his voice had sounded so mixed when he congratulated me. I could only stare into the broad face with its hate-burning eyes.
"And you?" Brother Jack said.
"I liked his speech," the man said. "I thought it was quite effective."
"And you?" Brother Jack said to the next man.
"I'm of the opinion that it was
a mistake.
And just why?
Because we must strive to reach the people through their intelligence.
Exactly, the brother with the pipe said. It was the antithesis of the scientific approach. Ours is a reasonable point of view. We are champions of a scientific approach to society. And such a speech as we've identified ourselves with tonight destroys everything that has been said before. The audience isn't thinking, it's yelling its head off.
Sure, it's acting like a mob,
the big black brother said. Brother Jack laughed. And this mob, he said, is it a mob against us, or is it a mob for us? How do our muscle-bound scientists answer that? But before they could answer, he continued, perhaps you're right. Perhaps it is a mob. But if it is, then it seems to be a mob that's simply boiling over to come along with us. And I shouldn't have to tell you theoreticians that science bases its judgments upon experiment. You're jumping to conclusions before the experiment has run its course. In fact, what's happening here tonight represents only one step in the experiment. The initial step, the release of energy. I can understand that it should make you timid. You're afraid of carrying through to the next step, because it's up to you to organize that energy. Well, it's going to be organized, and not by a bunch of timid, sideline theoreticians arguing in a vacuum, but by getting out and leading the people. He was fighting mad, looking from face to face, his red head bristling, but no one answered his challenge. It's disgusting, he said, pointing to me. Our new brother has succeeded by instinct where for 2 years your science has failed, and now all you can offer is destructive criticism. I beg to differ, the brother with the pipe said. To point out the dangerous nature of his speech isn't destructive criticism. Far from it. Like the rest of us, the new brother must learn to speak scientifically. He must be trained.
So at last it occurs to you, Brother Jack said, pulling down the corners of his mouth. Training. All is not lost. There's hope that our wild but effective speaker may be tamed. The scientists perceive a possibility. Very well, it has been arranged, perhaps not scientifically, but arranged nevertheless. For the next few months, our new brother is to undergo a period of intense study and indoctrination under the guidance of Brother Hambro. That's right, he said as I started to speak. I meant to tell you later.
But that's a long time, I said. How am I going to live?
Your salary will continue, he said. Meanwhile, you'll be guilty of no further unscientific speeches to upset our brother's scientific tranquility. In fact, you ought to stay completely out of Harlem. Perhaps then we'll see if you brothers are as swift at organizing as you are at criticizing. It's your move, brothers.
I think Brother Jack is correct, the short bald man said. I don't think that we, of all people, should be afraid of the people's enthusiasm. What we've got to do is to guide it into channels where it will do the most good.
The rest was silent, the brother with the pipe looking at me unbendingly.
Come, Brother Jack said. Let's get out of here. If we keep our eyes on the real goal, our chances are better than ever before. And let's remember that science isn't a game of chess, although chess may be played scientifically. The other thing to remember is that if we are to organize the masses, we must first organize ourselves. Thanks to our new brother, things have changed. We mustn't fail to make use of our opportunity. From now on, it's up to you.
We shall see, the brother with the pipe said. And as for the new brother, a few talks with Brother Hambro wouldn't harm anyone.
Hambro, I thought, going out. Who the hell is he? I suppose I'm lucky they didn't fire me. So, now I've got to go to school again. Out in the night, the group was breaking up and Brother Jack drew me aside. Don't worry, he said. You'll find Brother Hambro interesting, and a period of training was inevitable. Your speech tonight was a test which you passed with flying colors. So, now you'll be prepared for some real work. Here's the address. See Brother Hambrough the first thing in the morning. He's already been notified. When I reached home, tiredness seemed to explode within me. My nerves remained tense even after I had had a hot shower and crawled into bed. In my disappointment, I wanted only to sleep, but my mind kept wandering back to the rally. It had actually happened. I had been lucky and had said the right things at the right time, and they had liked me. Or perhaps I had said the wrong things in the right places. Whatever. They had liked it regardless of the brothers, and from now on, my life would be different. It was different already. For now, I realized that I meant everything that I had said to the audience, even though I hadn't known that I was going to say those things. I had intended only to make a good appearance, to say enough to keep the Brotherhood interested in me. What had come out was completely uncalculated, as though another self within me had taken over and held forth. And lucky that it had, or I might have been fired. Even my technique had been different. No one who had known me at college would have recognized the speech. But that was as it should have been, for I was someone new. Even though I had spoken in a very old-fashioned way. I had been transformed, and now, lying restless in bed in the dark, I felt a kind of affection for the blurred audience whose faces I had never clearly seen. They had been with me from the first word. They had wanted me to succeed. And fortunately, I had spoken for them, and they had recognized my words. I belonged to them. I sat up, grasping my knees in the dark as the thought struck home. Perhaps this was what was meant by being dedicated and set aside. Very well, if so, I accepted it. My possibilities were suddenly broadened. As a Brotherhood spokesman, I would represent not only my own group, but one that was much larger. The audience was mixed, their claims broader than race. I would do whatever was necessary to serve them well. If they could take a chance with me, then I'd do the very best that I could. How else could I save myself from disintegration? I sat there in the dark trying to recall the sequence of the speech. Already it seemed the expression of someone else. Yet I knew that it was mine, and mine alone. And if it was recorded by a stenographer, I would have to look at it tomorrow. Words, phrases skipped through my mind. I saw the blue haze again. What had I meant by saying that I had become more human? Was it a phrase that I had picked up from some preceding speaker or a slip of the tongue? For a moment I thought of my grandfather and quickly dismissed him. What had an old slave to do with humanity? Perhaps it was something that Woodbridge had said in the literature class back at college. Oh, I could see him vividly, half drunk on words and full of contempt and exaltation, pacing before the blackboard chalked with quotations from Joyce and Yeats and Sean O'Casey, thin, nervous, neat, pacing as though he walked a high wire of meaning upon which no one of us would ever dare venture. I could hear him. Stephen's problem, like ours, was not actually one of creating the uncreated conscience of his race, but of creating the uncreated features of his face. Our task is that of making ourselves individuals. The conscience of a race is the gift of its individuals who see, evaluate, record. We create the race by creating ourselves, and then, to our great astonishment, we will have created something far more important. We will have created a culture. Why waste time creating a conscience for something that doesn't exist?
for you see, blood and skin do not think.
But no, it wasn't Woodbridge.
More human. Did I mean that I had become less of what I was, less a Negro, or that I was less a being apart, less an exile from down home, the South? But all this is negative. To become less in order to become more? Perhaps that was it. But in what way more human? Even Woodridge hadn't spoken of such things. It was a mystery once more, as at the eviction I had uttered words that had possessed me. I thought of Bledsoe and Norton and what they had done. By kicking me into the dark, they'd made me see the possibility of achieving something greater and more important than I'd ever dreamed. Here was a way that didn't lead through the back door, a way not limited by black and white, but a way which, if one lived long enough and worked hard enough, could lead to the highest possible rewards. Here was a way to have a part in making the big decisions, of seeing through the mystery of how the country, the world, really operated. For the first time, lying there in the dark, I could glimpse the possibilities of being more than a member of a race. It was no dream. The possibility existed. I had only to work and learn and survive in order to go to the top. Ha! Sure. I'd study with Hambro, I'd learn what he had to teach, and a lot more. Let tomorrow come. The sooner I was through with this Hambro, the sooner I could get started with my work.
4 months later, when Brother Jack called the apartment at midnight to tell me to be prepared to take a ride, I became quite excited. Fortunately, I was awake and dressed, and when he drove up a few minutes later, I was waiting expectantly at the curb. Maybe, I thought, as I saw him hunched behind the wheel in his topcoat, this is what I've been waiting for. "How have you been, brother?" I said, getting in.
"A little tired," he said. "Not enough sleep. Too many problems."
Then, as he got the car underway, he became silent, and I decided not to ask any questions. That was one thing I had learned thoroughly. There must be something doing at the Thonian, I thought, watching him staring at the road as though lost in thought. Maybe the brothers are waiting to put me through my paces. If so, fine. I've been waiting for an examination. But instead of going to the Thonian, I looked out to discover that he had brought me to Harlem and was parking the car. "We'll have a drink," he said, getting out and heading for where the neon-lighted sign of a bull's head announced the El Toro bar. I was disappointed. I wanted no drink. I wanted to take the next step that lay between me and an assignment. I followed him inside with a surge of irritation. The barroom was warm and quiet. The usual rows of bottles with exotic names were lined on the shelves, and in the rear, where four men argued in Spanish over glasses of beer, a jukebox lit up green and red played Melia Luz, and as we waited for the bartender, I tried to figure the purpose of the trip. I had seen very little of Brother Jack after beginning my studies with Brother Hambro. My life had been too tightly organized, but I should have known that if anything was going to happen, Brother Hambro would have let me know. Instead, I was to meet him in the morning, as usual. That Hambro, I thought, he is a fanatic teacher. A tall, friendly man, a lawyer and the Brotherhood's chief theoretician, he had proved to be a hard taskmaster. Between daily discussions with him and a rigid schedule of reading, I had been working harder than I'd ever found necessary at college. Even my nights were organized. Every evening found me at some rally or meeting in one of the many districts, though this was my first trip to Harlem since my speech, where I'd sit on the platform with the speakers, making notes to be discussed with him the next day. Every occasion became a study situation, even the parties that sometimes followed the meetings. During these, I had to make mental notes on the ideological attitudes revealed in the guests' conversations. but I had soon learned the method in it. Not only had I been learning the many aspects of the Brotherhood's policy and its approach to various social groupings, but the citywide membership had grown familiar with me. My part in the eviction was kept very much alive, and although I was under orders to make no speeches, I had grown accustomed to being introduced as a kind of hero. Yet it had been mainly a time for listening, and being a talker, I had grown impatient. Now I knew most of the Brotherhood arguments so well, those I doubted as well as those I believed, that I could repeat them in my sleep, but nothing had been said about my assignment. Thus I had hoped the midnight call meant some kind of action was to begin. Beside me, Brother Jack was still lost in thought. He seemed in no hurry to go elsewhere or to talk. And as the slow-motion bartender mixed our drinks, I puzzled vainly as to why he had brought me here. Before me, in the panel where a mirror is usually placed, I could see a scene from a bullfight, the bull charging close to the man, and the man swinging the cape in sculptured folds so close to his body that man and bull seemed to blend in one swirl of calm, pure motion. Pure grace, I thought, looking above the bar to where, larger than life, the pink and white image of a girl smiled down from a summery beer ad on which a calendar said, April 1. Then, as our drinks were placed before us, Brother Jack came alive, his mood changing as though, in the instant, he had settled whatever had been bothering him and felt suddenly free.
"Here, come back," he said, nudging me playfully. "She's only a cardboard image of a cold steel civilization."
I laughed, glad to hear him joking. "And that," I said, pointing to the bullfight scene.
"Sheer barbarism," he said, watching the bartender and lowering his voice to a whisper. "But tell me, how have you found your work with Brother Hambro?"
"Oh, fine," I said. "He's strict. But if I'd had teachers like him in college, I'd know a few things. He's taught me a lot, but whether enough to satisfy the brothers who disliked my arena speech, I don't know. Shall we converse scientifically?" He laughed, one of his eyes glowing brighter than the other.
Don't worry about the brothers," he said. "You'll do very well. Brother Hambro's reports on you have been excellent."
"Now that's nice to hear," I said, aware now of another bullfight scene further down the bar, in which the matador was being swept skyward on the black bull's horns. "I've worked pretty hard trying to master the ideology."
"Master it," Brother Jack said, "but don't overdo it. Don't let it master you. There is nothing to put the people to sleep like dry ideology. The ideal is to strike a medium between ideology and inspiration. Say what the people want to hear, but say it in such a way that they'll do what we wish." He laughed. "Remember, too, that theory always comes after practice. Act first, theorize later. That's also a formula, a devastatingly effective one."
He looked at me as though he did not see me, and I could not tell whether he was laughing at me or with me. I was only sure that he was laughing. "Yes," I said, "I'll try to master all that is required."
"You can," he said. "And now, you don't have to worry about the brothers' criticism. Just throw some ideology back at them and they'll leave you alone. Provided, of course, that you have the right backing and produce the required results. Another drink?"
Thanks, I've had enough."
"Are you sure?"
"Sure."
"Good. Now, to your assignment. Tomorrow you are to become chief spokesman of the Harlem District."
"What?"
"Yes. The committee decided yesterday."
"But I had no idea."
"You'll do all right. Now listen, you ought to continue what you started at the eviction. Keep them stirred up, get them active. Get as many to join as possible. You'll be given guidance by some of the older members, but for the time being, you are to see what you can do. You will have freedom of action, and you will be under strict discipline to the committee."
"I see," I said.
"No, you don't quite see," he said, "but you will.
You must not underestimate the discipline, brother. It makes you answerable to the entire organization for what you do. Don't underestimate the discipline. It's very strict, but within its framework, you are to have full freedom to do your work. And your work is very important, understand? His eyes seemed to crowd my face as I nodded yes. We'd better go now so that you can get some sleep, he said, draining his glass. You're a soldier now. Your health belongs to the organization. I'll be ready, I said. I know you will. Until tomorrow, then, you'll meet with the executive committee of the Harlem section at 9 a.m. You know the location, of course. No, brother, I don't. Oh, that's right. Then you'd better come up with me for a minute. I have to see someone there, and you can take a look at where you'll work. I'll drop you off on the way down, he said. The district offices were located in a converted church structure, the main floor of which was occupied by a pawn shop, its window crammed with loot that gleamed dully in the darkened street. We took a stair to the third floor, entering a large room beneath a high Gothic ceiling. It's down here, Brother Jack said, making for the end of the large room where I saw a row of smaller ones, only one of which was lighted. And now I saw a man appear in the door and limp forward.
Evening, Brother Jack, he said.
Why, Brother Tarp, I expected to find Brother Tobit.
I know. He was here, but he had to leave, the man said. He left his envelope for you and said he'd call you later tonight.
Good, good, Brother Jack said. Oh, here, meet a new brother.
Pleased to meet you,
the brother said, smiling.
I heard you speak at the arena. You really told him.
Thanks, I said. So you liked it, did you, Brother Tarp? Brother Jack said.
The boy's all right with me, the man said.
Well, you're going to see a lot of him. He's your new spokesman.
That's fine, the man said. Looks like we're going to get some changes made.
Correct, Brother Jack said. Now let's take a look at his office and we'll be going.
Sure, brother,
Tarp said, limping before me into one of the dark rooms and snapping on a light.
This here's the one.
I looked into a small office containing a flat-top desk with a telephone, a typewriter on its table, a bookcase with shelves of books and pamphlets, and a huge map of the world inscribed with ancient nautical signs and a heroic figure of Columbus to one side. If there's anything you need, just see Brother Tarp, Brother Jack said. He's here at all times. Thanks, I shall, I said. I'll get oriented in the morning. Yes, and we'd better go so you can get some sleep. Good night, Brother Tarp. See that everything is ready for him in the morning.
You won't have to worry about a thing, brother. Good night.
It's because we attract men like Brother Tarp that we shall triumph, he said as we climbed into the car. He's old physically, but ideologically, he's a vigorous young man. He can be depended upon in the most precarious circumstance. He sounds like a good man to have around, I said. You'll see, he said, and lapsed into a silence that lasted until we reached my door. The committee was assembled in the hall with the high Gothic ceiling when I arrived, sitting in folding chairs around two small tables pushed together to form a unit. Well, Brother Jack said, you are on time. Very good. We favor precision in our leaders. Brother, I shall always try to be on time, I said. Here he is, brothers and sisters, he said. Your new spokesman. Now, to begin, are we all present?
All except Brother Todd Clifton, someone said.
His red head jerked with surprise. So?
He'll be here, a young brother said. We were working until 3 this morning.
Still, he should be on time. Very well, Brother Jack said, taking out a watch. Let us begin. I have only a little time here, but a little time is all that is needed. You all know the events of the recent period and the role our new brother has played in them. Briefly, you are here to see that it isn't wasted. We must achieve 2 things. We must plan methods of increasing the effectiveness of our agitation, and we must organize the energy that has already been released. This calls for a rapid increase of membership.
The people are fully aroused. If we fail to lead them into action, they will become passive or they will become cynical. Thus, it is necessary that we strike immediately and strike hard. For this purpose, he said, nodding toward me, our brother has been appointed district spokesman. You are to give him your loyal support and regard him as the new instrument of the committee's authority. I heard the slight applause splatter up, only to halt with the opening of the door, and I looked down past the rows of chairs to where a hatless young man, about my own age, was coming into the hall. He wore a heavy sweater and slacks, and as the others looked up, I heard the quick intake of a woman's pleasurable sigh. Then the young man was moving with an easy Negro stride out of the shadow into the light, and I saw that he was very black and very handsome, and as he advanced mid-distance into the room, that he possessed the chiseled black marble features sometimes found on statues in northern museums, and alive in southern towns in which the white offspring of house children and the black offspring of yard children bear names, features, and character traits as identical as the rifling of bullets fired from a common barrel. And now close up, leaning tall and relaxed, his arms outstretched stiffly upon the table, I saw the broad, taut span of his knuckles upon the dark grain of the wood, the muscular, sweated arms, the curving line of the chest rising to the easy pulsing of his throat, to the square, smooth chin, and saw a small, X-shaped patch of adhesive upon the subtly blended velvet over stone, granite over bone, Afro-Anglo-Saxon contour of his cheek. He leaned there, looking at us all with a remote aloofness, in which I sensed an unstated questioning beneath the friendly charm. Sensing a possible rival, I watched him warily, wondering who he was.
"Ah, so Brother Todd Clifton is late," Brother Jack said. "Our leader of the youth is late. Why is this?"
The young man pointed to his cheek and smiled. I had to see the doctor, he said.
What is this? Brother Jack said, looking at the cross of adhesive on the black skin.
Just a little encounter with the Nationalists, with Ross the extorter's boys, Brother Clifton said, and I heard a gasp from one of the women who gazed at him with shining, compassionate eyes. Brother Jack gave me a quick look.
Brother, you have heard of Ross. He's the wild man who calls himself a black nationalist.
I don't recall so, I said.
You'll hear of him soon enough. Sit down, Brother Clifton, sit down. You must be careful. You are valuable to the organization. You must not take chances.
This was unavoidable, the young man said.
Just the same, Brother Jack said, returning to the discussion with a call for ideas.
Brother, are we still to fight against evictions, I said.
It has become a leading issue, thanks to you.
Then why not step up the fight?
He studied my face. What do you suggest?
Well, since it's attracted so much attention, why not try to reach the whole community with the issue?
And how would you suggest we go about it?
I suggest we get the community leaders on record in support of us.
There are certain difficulties in face of this, Brother Jack said. Most of the leaders are against us.
But I think he's got something there, Brother Clifton said. What if we got them to support the issue, whether they like us or not? The issue is a community issue. It's nonpartisan. Sure, I said, that's how it looks to me. With all the excitement over evictions, they can't afford to come out against us, not without appearing to be against the best interests of the community. So we have them across a barrel, Clifton said.
That is perceptive enough, Brother Jack said.
The others agreed.
You see, Brother Jack said with a grin, we've always avoided these leaders, but the moment we start to advance on a broad front, sectarianism becomes a burden to be cast off. Any other suggestions?
He looked around. Brother, I said, remembering now, when I first came to Harlem, one of the first things that impressed me was a man making a speech from a ladder. He spoke very violently and with an accent, but he had an enthusiastic audience. Why can't we carry our program to the street in the same way?
So you have met him, he said, suddenly grinning. Well, Ross the Exhorter has had a monopoly in Harlem, but now that we are larger, we might give it a try.
What the committee wants is results. So that was Ross the exhorter, I thought.
We'll have big trouble with the extorter, the exhorter, a big woman said. His hoodlums would attack and denounce the white meat of a roasted chicken.
We laughed.
He goes wild when he sees black people and white people together, she said to me. We'll take care of that, Brother Clifton said, touching his cheek.
Very well, but no violence, Brother Jack said. The Brotherhood is against violence and terror and provocation of any kind. Aggressive, that is. Understand, Brother Clifton?
I understand, he said.
We will not countenance any aggressive violence, understand? Nor attacks upon officials or others who do not attack us. We are against all forms of violence. Do you understand?
Yes, brother, I said.
Very well. Having made this clear, I leave you now, he said. See what you can accomplish. You'll have plenty of support from other districts and all the guidance you need. Meanwhile, remember that we are all under discipline. He left, and we divided the labor. I suggested that each work in the area he knew best. Since there was no liaison between the Brotherhood and the community leaders, I assigned myself the task of creating one. It was decided that our street meetings begin immediately, and that Brother Todd Clifton was to return and go over the details with me. While the discussion continued, I studied their faces. They seemed absorbed with the cause and in complete agreement, blacks and whites. But when I tried to place them as to type, I got nowhere. The big woman who looked like a southern sudsbuster was in charge of women's work and spoke in abstract ideological terms. The shy-looking man with the liver splotches on his neck spoke with a bold directness and eagerness for action. And this Brother Todd Clifton, the young leader, looked somehow like a hipster, a zoot suiter, a sharpie, except his head of Persian lamb's wool had never known a straightener. I could place none of them. They seemed familiar, but were just as different as Brother Jack and the other whites were from all the white men I had known. They were all transformed, like familiar people seen in a dream. Well, I thought, I'm different too, and they'll see it when the talk is finished and the action begins. I'll just have to be careful not to antagonize anyone. As it is, someone might resent my being placed in charge. But when Brother Todd Clifton came into my office to discuss the street meeting, I saw no signs of resentment, but a complete absorption in the strategy of the meeting. With great care, he went about instructing me how to deal with hecklers, on what to do if we were attacked, and upon how to recognize our members from the rest of the crowd. For all his seeming zoot-suiter characteristics, his speech was precise, and I had no doubt that he knew his business. "How do you think we'll do?" I said when he had finished.
"It'll go big, man," he said. "It'll be bigger than anything since Garvey."
"I wish I could be so sure," I said. I never saw Garvey."
"I didn't either," he said. "But I understand that in Harlem he was very big."
"Well, we're not Garvey, and he didn't last."
"No, but he must have had something," he said with sudden passion. "He must have had something to move all those people. Our people are hell to move. He must have had plenty."
I looked at him. His eyes were turned inward. Then he smiled.
"Don't worry," he said. "We have a scientific plan, and you set them off. Things are so bad, they'll listen. And when they listen, they'll go along."
"I hope so," I said.
"They will. You haven't been around the movement as I have for 3 years now, and I can feel the change. They're ready to move."
"I hope your feelings are right," I said.
"They're right, all right," he said. "All we have to do is gather them in."
The evening was almost of a winter coldness. The corner well lighted and the all-Negro crowd large and tightly packed. Up on the ladder now, I was surrounded by a group of Clifton's youth division, and I could see beyond their backs with upturned collars the faces of the doubtful, the curious, and the convinced in the crowd. It was early, and I threw my voice hard down against the traffic sounds, feeling the damp coldness of the air upon my cheeks and hands as my voice warmed with my emotion. I had just begun to feel the pulsing set up between myself and the people, hearing them answering in staccato applause and agreement, when Todd Clifton caught my eye, pointing. and over the heads of the crowd and down past the dark storefronts and blinking neon signs, I saw a bristling band of about 20 men quick-stepping forward. I looked down. It's trouble.